You appreciate it.
Okay. Ready, Julie?
Yeah.
Okay, let's get started here. We're starting a work session on case number PU-13-136. It's an application for a siting application from Highland Crude, LLC. This is actually a gathering pipeline that is already in existence, was completed in 2013. It traverses parts of McKenzie, Williams, and Montreal counties. And the application, the siting application, is because of the desire to add tanks and additional pressure to move more oil, and it would bring it up to the standards to qualify as a transmission line, which requires the siting. Commissioner Kalk is at another meeting, expects to be here shortly, but asks that we just get it started. I don't have any opening comments. Do you have any opening comments?
I don't.
Okay. With us at the table is Brian Schmidt, counsel for the commission, as well as Julie Prescott. And who's going to take over at this point?
I can start since it's my portfolio.
Oh, okay.
Take
ahead.
Over. So Brian and Julie and I talked last week about what we wanted to accomplish at today's press or work session. And there were a number of late filed exhibits requested at the hearing, and they have all been received, correct?
Not quite correct. We've received 7 of the 9.
So what we thought we'd do today is go through them, and Brian is prepared to kind of walk us through each of the late filed exhibits and speak to them, and we can ask him questions. There is not a draft order yet, or did they send one in the last day?
I've been in contact with Jillian Rupnow, who's the attorney for Highland on this. They are in the process of putting it together. We can probably expect one within the next few days, it sounds like.
So. Okay. So we'll just go through the late filed exhibits, kind of refresh ourselves on the key points of this case, and then we'll have to likely get back together for another work session to go through the draft order. So you can take it away, Brian.
All right.
Thank you.
First thing I would like to point out is, after the hearing, Lawrence Bender, Jillian Rupnow, and I got together via email and telephone conference and kind of identified what the late filed exhibits should be for this. We identified 9 of them. Of the 9 that we have identified and submitted to the ALJ, 7 have been turned in. The numbers corresponding to the stipulation regarding late filed exhibits on the docket do not perfectly correlate with the title of the exhibits as submitted. They just did it 1 through 7. And the late files that were still missing would be Exhibit 9 listed on the stipulation, which is the noise impact study and the maps depicting locations of potential impact for noise, and the list of federal, state, and local permits that were acquired for the project, which is listed as number 6 on the stipulation, but it's not Exhibit 6 on the late files. So just to clear up any confusion there, moving forward, the numbers don't perfectly correlate. However, of the 7 that we do have, they are all titled, and they do fall in with what we have identified, so there shouldn't be any issues as far as that goes. The first exhibit, labeled as Exhibit number 1 under the late files, is a chart, which is the start and end dates for each part of the segment. The best way to, and just for the record, in case you want to go back and compare later, to color code these different segments, I used figure 3.A.1 from the application, which was the big map that they had posted at the actual hearings.
Okay.
Essentially, it just shows the start date and end date of the construction of each of the segments. The first one they have is Segment 1, which is a Tioga project. Started in September 10th, and started in September of 2010 and ended in May of 2011. Everything else just kind of seems to follow suit with essentially what was stated at the hearing. I believe most of the dates are fairly consistent. They have the 6 segments listed in the table just as they had depicted on the map. And as pointed out earlier by Commissioner Chrisman, the construction went from September of 2010 through March of 2013. I guess one thing that I would point out that I'm a little confused about is they talked about the loop at the hearing, and that doesn't appear to be in this chart. So I believe they stated the construction for that wasn't completed until 2014, early 2014 at the hearing. But other than that, everything else seemed to be fairly accurate or fairly consistent with what was stated at the hearing.
Why would the loop not be in here, do you think?
I don't really have any great idea as to why that wouldn't be in here. I don't think I'm in a position to speculate on that. I can talk with council to see if it was an oversight or to see if that's incorporated within one of these segments.
Because it's clearly part of this project as included in the application.
That's my understanding, yes. I know it was alluded to in the application, and we discussed it at the hearing, so
mm-hmm.
I'm thinking that that loop's either incorporated in one of these six segments or there's just something that they forgot to put in.
Okay.
I'll have to get clarity on that issue.
Okay. Brian, just to bring you up to speed, welcome. We're going through the late filed exhibits, and they have submitted 7 of the 9 requested at the end of the hearing, and they are working on a draft order and expect to have that in the next few days, and so we'll probably gather for another work session after we have a draft order. So today we're just kind of catching up on where we are with late filed exhibits and going through them.
Thank you, ma'am.
Ready to move on to exhibit number 2?
Sure.
Okay. Exhibit number 2 is the dig depth map. Let me pull it up on my iPad here. Okay, it doesn't really show up any better here.
Yeah, you need to.
You have to zoom in pretty intensely to be able to see the figures on this, but I was able to make out the majority of what it said through the magic of the PDF zoom function. The way I was able to figure this out, the deepest level that it got to was 180 inches, and that was in section 150 north, 96 west. And the shallowest it ever got was 42 inches, and that was in section 155 north, 102 west.
46 inches, did you say?
42 was the shallowest, and the deepest was 180.
What did we ask them? What were the criteria for where they were providing the depths? I remember discussing that quite at length during the hearing.
I guess, can you clarify that a little bit more?
Well, how did they pick which depths they were going to share with us?
Right. I guess I don't exactly know how they decided. It seems like there's just some probably different points where they changed the depth is where they made the markings on there. As far as to what's not on the map, I don't know.
Didn't we talk about they were going to give us their borings, and then we were going to look at it and see if we'd require additional borings?
I believe
so. There wasn't a protocol on what they did. I mean, it just was.
Okay.
But then we wanted to get a feel for, like, how far apart they are, and if they were all in the same, I don't know, area, we'd ask for some additional ones.
Right.
So is there a methodology, like how far they are apart now, that you can delineate?
How far the borings are apart as of right now?
Yeah, could you get like some generalization since you see the map of, you know, is there a boring every 5 miles or something? Was there some type of?
You know, looking at this, it doesn't seem to be overly consistent, I guess, as to where it would be. I don't think there's a specific distance that they went between bores or anything like that.
Maybe another way is to find out. We should find out the longest segment of pipe that there was not a boring conducted in.
Okay.
You know, if there was a boring every mile, that's one thing. If there was not, there was 40 miles where there wasn't a boring, we might ask for an additional one as a thought.
The whole point being we want to confirm the depth
right.
as accurately as possible.
It may have been, this is Pathon, it may have been that they were going to provide the depth at locations where they had to dig up the pipeline after they sent the smart pig through where they found an anomaly.
Oh, sure.
I don't know if anybody remembers anything
I
like
do
that,
remember but. Something like that. I remember there being a trigger point where we said, if you... Is that what you have in your notes, Julie?
I have in my notes that we would provide for the whole project, quote for the whole project. And then we ask for some sort of representative along the whole
sample.
Route. But they did provide these exposed pipe reports that show depths on there, and I don't know if that's exactly what this represents, what Pat was saying.
Yeah, the way it's described in the exhibit list is map depicting depth of pipeline at various points through the system as determined by digs. So I believe that the depth that's depicted on that map would be places where they have dug in and they recorded it and put it onto a map, essentially seems to be what we're dealing with exhibit number 2.
Okay. All right, and did they agree to 42 inches or 48 inches throughout the length of the project?
That is something that's in the certification, which I'm trying to pull up right now because I can't remember either off the top of my head.
I could have made a mistake. I have in my notes that they said that the entire pipeline is buried at least 4 feet.
That's what I recalled as well.
But I...
48 inches, so... Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay. So we'll have to rectify, you know, what to do about that.
Right, and again, with regard to that 42-inch number, I'm looking through a fuzzy thing on that, you know, pretty fuzzy text on that when you blow it up that much. So that's what it looked like to me. It may be something else. I can call and get that verified from council, too. They may have a cleaner copy of it to look at to get some clarity on that issue.
No, that's good. Okay. Any other questions on that one?
Some of these pipe inspection reports do show less than 48 inches, these exposed pipe reports. There's one that says 44.
Okay.
I think there was one that did say 42 as well, or 43. So there's other sources of that information.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you sit up here, Pat? You were at the hearing, and I think you should be part of this conversation. Move that. Yeah, here.
I just had a thought. I was just wondering if there was a particular segment where we're finding the shallower depths.
The depth at 42 inches is in, I said, section 155 north, 102 west. On here, and for some reason it turns every time I try to look at it.
It might be something that we can check later.
Right. Mm-hmm. It should be pretty easy to find. It's near Bethel is where that would be on here. Between West Creek Camp and Bethel.
Bethel Station is right there.
And the numbers depicted in red.
You mentioned two others. You mentioned three altogether.
Well, they're it's questionable. They're talking about this catwalk area is one of them where they're showing less than.
Yeah, and it appears if you go just east of where it states Bethel on there into section 156 north, 100 west, it shows it's at 44 inches there. So there may be something that causes them to go at a lesser depth in that area.
Mm-hmm. If we were constructing this, you know, is that something that the construction inspectors would check or be watching for, the depth?
They are to do that, yes.
So what do we do in the case like this where it's already in the ground and it's not deep enough?
I don't know that the commission has ever
had to deal with that
at this point.
Okay. Well, I guess that's something we'll have to think about here.
We do know, Pat, though, that everything works its way to the surface over time. Pipelines work their way up. So we've had pipelines that have actually daylighted that we've found out there that we've had the companies go back and fix, correct?
The first part, for sure. We know that there are pipelines that have
over 50 years that worked their way up like anything else in the winter.
I don't know that we've actually addressed it.
Okay.
I mean, the company is certainly protecting that pipeline the way it is in that situation it is in. But I don't know that we've gone back and addressed that.
Okay. What's the federal standard on how deep a pipeline needs to be?
It's more likely going to be 36 inches.
And what's the protocol on if you have those major pipelines that over time push up because of natural things that happen in the winter?
From the federal side? From the federal view?
Yeah.
Well, I know that they haven't done anything in this particular instance I'm thinking of, so I think it's to protect it.
Extra flagging or whatever it might be.
I think it's actually restricted from the agricultural production, and the landowners compensated probably for it.
Okay. A little bit off topic, but just a little bit. I know we've had discussion on different cases about that. Back to the concern, that's why you call before you dig, right? Because it doesn't always going to be at 48 inches.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions on the depths from Randy or Brian?
Well, I don't know that a question, just maybe we'll just... It sounds like we've got pipe that's out there that's not 48 inches.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to figure out a way around that. Either it's going to make them dig it deeper or have some provision in the order that shows that. How much can they tell us where the depth of the pipeline is that with certainty is what we were driving at the hearing.
Well, and they're certifying that it's, you know, they agreed to certify that it'd be at 48 inches. So the only value of that, them doing that, is us knowing that they're at 48 inches. And so if we know that they aren't at 48 inches, then what good is that certification?
Brian, you'll have to talk to the company and Julie about that and just pose that question to them and see what their response is, because clearly they contradict each other.
We can definitely do that and get some answers to those questions.
Yep. Okay. All righty. Then can we move on to Exhibit 3? You all right?
Sure.
Brian?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Exhibit 3 is the exhibit depicting the block valve map. And again, this one is kind of difficult to see. I zoomed in as much as I could. It appears there's either 25 or 26 block valves along there. There was a couple that kind of overlapped, and I couldn't tell if it was one valve or two valves. As far as any specific points of interest, they seem to mainly be around the different stations along the pipeline and near some minor water crossings. I don't know if there's really any value in me going through each individual block valve orally right now, but if you have any questions, I can try to address those.
Were these exhibits filed in a larger format and then shrunk down for docketing purposes, or is this what the best that we have to look at?
This is the best. I pulled the PDF CD in order to determine, because I can't read. It's illegible to me.
Right.
To decipher what that is. And I wasn't able to get anything better than that.
We better ask the company to send it to us in higher resolution or something to that effect so we can see what they say. Yeah. That'll be helpful for all of these maps, I think.
And the block valves depicted on Late Valley Exhibit 3, they're very difficult to see. I mean, you have to really zoom in and mm-hmm. kind of follow the entire pipeline. So as far as the specific location goes, you know, I think it's kind of a guess just based on how small
right.
it really is.
Okay. Done with that one? Randy, Brian?
Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Just to your point, Julie, if the company wants us to make a decision, they need to start giving us good data. That's ridiculous. So make sure you tell them that, too.
Okay. Noted. Moving on to exhibit number 4. This is the emergency response plan that they have submitted. The way it appears to work is they have a emergency response contractor called Clean Harbors, who they work on a master service agreement with. Clean Harbors essentially is at their beck and call 24/7, 365. Something goes wrong, Clean Harbors is the one who's going to respond, but Highland doesn't own or maintain any emergency response stuff. That's all outsourced. Another kind of interesting thing that was in this emergency response plan is a worst-case scenario simulation. All the way along the system, it appears the worst-case scenario would be if there was a discharge at Gore Station. This could result in potentially 30,000 barrels of oil leaking out. However, they do have a containment capacity, which is 110% of the breakout capacity, so it'd be they're able to contain 110% of 30,000, and unfortunately, I'm a lawyer, not a mathematician, so I don't have that number off the top of my head, but that's what they have as far as
33,000.
Bingo.
I'm not a mathematician either. But
the next thing that they discuss within this the simulation depicting the worst case possibilities is if there was a leak on the pipe. And if that happened, the worst-case scenario of an actual pipeline leak would be between Beaver Lodge and Saddle Butte, which would result in 10,612 barrels leaking. They also note on there that no spills have been reported on the system to date. So that was kind of the essence of what they went through as far as their emergency or their worst-case scenario simulation with regard to the entire system.
But it should be pointed out, though, unless I'm incorrect, that their response plan they already have in place has already been signed off on by PHMSA, correct?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, so is there changes that are going to be required to their current plan on file for this one?
I don't believe so. Yeah.
So when you say that, what you talked about the subcontractor, they've already got a plan that's been approved by the people that approve these plans.
I believe so. I guess I can't say that with absolute certainty, but it appears to be that way, yes. And the actual response plan is fairly voluminous. It covers quite a bit of stuff. A lot of it is fairly consistent with what we see in other pipeline applications and response plans. So it was nothing really that stuck out as far as being odd or obscure with regard to this one.
All right. Any more questions?
Well, just something to think about. We're not listed as an agency that has to be notified on when there's a spill above certain size. I don't know if that's something that we should start putting in orders or not, because when there is a leak in these pipelines, we get notified through the national response system. We don't get directly notified. Is that something that we'd be interested in doing? Because
we did
in one of them, but I don't know exactly if. I'm not sure. That's why I ask.
Okay. Didn't we add it to our certification, our standard certification?
I remember in the certification that we have an item for if you dig and you hit another facility or during construction, that you're supposed to stop at that location, but stop construction. But I don't know, during construction, if there is any damage or injury or injury to a critical, like an eagle's nest or something like that, they're supposed to report it to us. I don't know if there's anything in there about notifying us anytime in the future about a leak.
We've done it somewhere. I don't know if it was the Enbridge pipeline or something, some project that we approved recently, as I recall, we added that as a provision.
See, I think it was an intrastate line that we added it in there, and that's what this would be, an intrastate line. So if it's okay with you two, I think we should put some kind of language in there about that, that we get notified immediately, and how we they notify the National Command Center and it trickles back down to us, since we're the ones citing this thing.
I agree. And I believe we did start including that in our standard certification after the Tioga spill.
I don't recall.
We don't have a proposal.
We'll have to look at the certification, but I don't recall seeing that in there. Other than what Pat said, it's in there if they hit something when they're building, but during operation, I don't know that it says that.
I will. I'll
just
check,
double check
the certification, and then if
it's not there, put it in there. Yeah.
Okay. Comment. I don't see McKenzie County's emergency management listed on here. Is that? I don't know on notifications. They've got the sheriff's department and they have Montreal Emergency Management, but is there a system for that? Why they wouldn't contact McKenzie County's emergency management? It's not the same party. It's not a dual office.
Them and the sheriff's department is not a...
No, it's Jerry Salmonson is the
emergency
manager, but they have a different sheriff. So I don't... Anyway, it was just a thought.
Well, ask the question, Julie. Talk to them and ask them why it's not. And if they don't have a good reason, then put down in ours, notify us and the county emergency manager. As a thought.
A good catch.
Mm-hmm. All right. Anything else on emergency management? For now? Okay. Then next up, Brian.
Yeah. Late file exhibit number 5. Is the residence map. It's the map that depicts the 5 residences that are located within 500 feet of the pipeline who have refused to sign the waiver. Moving from top to bottom on the map, they're listed 1 through 5. I'll just read off the names. One of them is very familiar. Seems like the parties are Leonard McGinnity is number 1. Number 2 is Laverne and Juliana Vance. Number 3 is Wade and Melissa Smith. Number 4 is Dave and Arliss Maline. And number 5 is Lyle and Dorothy Kuster. There's a kind of a cluster of homes on here. Numbers 3, 4, and 5 would be the Smith, Maline, and Kuster residences. They're all very close together, and it appears that they haven't obtained waivers from any of those parties, and I haven't been updated as whether they've received waivers from any of these parties since the hearing. I haven't heard anything that they have.
And the only information I'm aware of receiving directly from these parties is from the Vances.
That is correct. And the Vances are the ones who appeared at the hearing.
Correct. Okay. We haven't received letters, Julie, from any of the others.
No.
And not before the hearing either.
Can you say that one more time, Julie?
It still shows 5 outstanding in the late filed exhibits, so no, I don't.
No, I mean just rationale, complaints, or anything like that, not letters of certification.
I haven't received any.
The Vance's attorney did send our office. Our office is in possession of some correspondence as far as that goes, but it's nothing that wasn't covered at the actual hearings. So.
Okay. Well, I have a couple different directions on this subject. In the original application, in tab 3, page 40, it says that Highland has obtained waivers from all but two residences. Did we ever discuss that?
Yeah, we did.
Different than what it has turned out to be? Or
we did. There was some confusion with regard to a couple of these landowners, mainly because where the land is located, where the pipeline goes through, whoever is owning the land where the pipeline is located doesn't necessarily own the residence that's within 500 feet of the pipeline. So I think there was some confusion as to who they had to obtain the waiver from. And since it's the residence, that's the owner of the residence that signs off on the waiver, and they're not the same person as the landowner in some of these situations, there was a misunderstanding, and that's what led to the different numbers showing up within the application.
And did we not also hear in the discussion when it was that there were five, that three of the five didn't sign it, but it was because their attorney said that they don't have to?
Yes.
Well, if we require it, but the people's attorney says they don't have to, but they're not really protesting, how do we resolve that ever?
I think there's a few different routes one could take. The easiest would obviously be encouraging the company to work with the landowner and get something resolved, just as simply as that. The other option would be to, approve the pipeline with some conditions that would make them go outside of the 500 feet if they cannot obtain a waiver or show a reasonable alternative for the route.
It seems overboard to me at this point to move the pipe because someone doesn't sign something that's not protesting it, but their attorney just says they don't need to sign it.
Right.
And now, the ones who are actually protesting it, that might be a different story, but I think that's the first step. We've got to figure out what to do about the ones who don't object but just don't want to sign.
Yeah, we need to know the fact that they haven't signed it suggests to me that they object. So until the company can get those signed, to me they're an objector.
That's fair. I guess to directly answer Randy's prior question, the easiest way to resolve this is obviously just to get the company to sit down with the landowners and get something figured out on the front end of this, then it would basically resolve itself. But if that doesn't happen, those would be the other potential avenues we'd have to explore as far as making this compliant with the law.
Okay. Do you know which of the five landowners, could you go by landowner, what is the scenario? They object or they don't object, but they just haven't signed. Do you know that detail yet?
Outside of just the Vances, who stated their case fairly clearly at the actual hearing, I don't know why the other four landowners haven't signed. I haven't heard anything, haven't heard a peep out of any of them. So as far as the reasoning goes for them, I do not know.
Well, maybe we go back and ask for additional information for Exhibit 5, just as how we would do what Randy asked for.
Yep.
So that would involve McGinty's and Smith, Moline, Keister. But given let's just take the, were you done, Randy? I didn't mean to cut you off.
I am.
Let's just take the Vances, for example. I'm trying to think, okay, this is not a power line. And I'm not a judge, and this is not our purview, but, well, it is, kind of because it's a factor. If this is a power line, and you're down to a person that doesn't sign the 500-foot waiver, we can do a finding that says, here's why we think it's not an issue, and then there's a legal process that the power lines tend to be very successful because that's the way power line law is. But isn't pipeline law a whole different kettle of fish?
Well,
and that's just a general discussion point that we need to be very careful about this. This is not a power line.
Correct. I mean, the statute on it's fairly clear. It's either you have to get a waiver, or you have to show that there's no reasonable alternative to going within 500 feet of a rural residence.
That would be reasonable alternative for the judge?
Yeah. I mean, that'd be for the finder of fact to determine that this wasn't a reasonable alternative. So that would fall into your hands for.
Okay, but let's just say we do that. We find the reasonable alternative, but then they still can't just do it, they've got to go. They have to go through the eminent domain, don't they? I mean, if this was not in the ground right now, they couldn't just start digging in this guy's property.
That's a very interesting question based on the way this whole thing played out. As far as the eminent domain would go, something I'd have to look into.
It's not their easement.
The distinction here is it's not their property.
Right.
It's not on their property.
And I believe
it's not Vance's land that the pipeline is on.
And I believe all the landowners who had the pipeline go across their land, they must have either obtained an easement or went through the eminent domain because the property's already been taken.
Right.
But in a different hypothetical, I guess I wouldn't exactly know what the answer to that would
be. Well, that's something that if you could do some research on the legal side, is that just to kind of walk through that line of questioning. And then why do we have that in the place, the 500 feet?
Mm-hmm.
It's a state regulation. It's not a federal one.
Right, and if they were unable to obtain an easement, they would have to go through the eminent domain process before they could just go in and take the land.
I think go ahead, Randy.
In this case, they were able to obtain the easement from the landowner where they wanted to bury.
Correct.
So I'm a little confused now. Is this what you're going to research, or do you know the answer to this question?
Well,
if we were starting a brand new project here, this wasn't built yet, and the Vances said we object to it being this close, and the pipeline company said this is the only reasonable alternative we have, this landowner will not allow us to go out further into that field, we could determine that there is no other reasonable alternative and approve it over the objections of Mr. Vance. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's my understanding of the law on that issue. And in that case, they would likely not sign an easement, and they would have to go through the court system for an eminent domain lawsuit.
But they don't have to sign
an
easement.
I guess not an easement, but a waiver in this situation.
And then they would still – do they need the waiver if we say that there's no other alternative?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
The statute's written with a disjunctive or in there and not an and, so either one would be sufficient.
And that's our decision. It's not a judge –
As to whether there's a reasonable alternative, yes, right. that would fall under your decision.
Now they could object, I suppose, and take it to the next level.
It would go through the appeal process to the district court, eventually the Supreme Court, if need be. But
you would use the record evidence that the company provided,
mm-hmm.
right,
for determining whether there was a reasonable alternative.
Now we talked about this last week, Brian, but share with my colleagues.
The other Brian, so we don't want to have any legal meetings.
Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Schmidt, yes. At the hearing, we asked if they looked into any other alternatives, and they essentially said they didn't.
That's my recollection as to what the testimony came out as. However, that was the oral testimony. They have provided a lot of other information in the application and in various other places. As far as, you know, determining what is considered to be reasonable, I guess that would be kind of up to each individual commissioner. If they feel that the evidence that they've supplied is enough to make a determination that there is no reasonable alternative, I believe there's probably enough information in the record as a whole which would support that, but there was some testimony that indicated that other reasonable alternatives to going within the 500 feet of some of these residences weren't evaluated because they were able to obtain easements from the landowners on which the pipeline went into.
I believe my recollection from the materials and the hearing was that they chose the route that they did because that's what the landowner who was providing the easement preferred. But whether that landowner refused, that was not at all clear.
I would agree.
To move that into the middle of the field away from the 500 feet.
I would agree with that observation, I guess.
And that's a huge distinction.
Huge distinction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, can you flesh out the exact situation for the next work session of all five of these to make sure that the landowners in question either have signed or haven't signed the easements? Because we're relatively certain that these five aren't landowners that have reached.
Oh, no. They're homeowners. They're not. They are landowners, but they're homeowners or people who are living.
But they don't own the property that is there anywhere on this route that we have the person that is refusing to sign to convert this to a transmission line? Back to the question of two that you asked in the beginning.
Being the pipeline holder.
The easement holder's
refusing.
Right. I don't believe that's necessarily been an issue. I think there might have been a confusion as far as whether we were talking about easements or waivers earlier. Exhibit 5 is specifically about waivers. So it would be the 500-foot waiver.
But have you verified that 100% of the easements are in place on the current route?
That I have not, and I can get some more.
I think that's got to be big, right? They were in place originally, but do they have to get a different easement when it changes?
Are you referring to if the route of the pipeline changed?
No, changing from transmission.
Okay. As far as whether they'd have to get a new easement for that, it would depend on what the terms of that easement would be between the owner and the landowner and the company. If there was something specifically in their easement that said this is an easement only for a gathering line, then I suppose they would have to get a new easement. If it was an easement that said something to the effects of any pipeline,
Brian, that's the part that I'd like to figure out. Just those five people. Let's find out the scenario.
Okay.
Are all five of these people that they're within 500 feet, they don't have any of the property, make sure that's clear. And then is there anywhere else in the route that there's an easement concern of the actual property owner where the pipeline goes through? Does that make sense?
Well, I get the question, but the ultimate big question, I'm not getting the pipeline company's logic on this one. It sounds to me like they're trying to suggest that there was a misunderstanding and they thought they just needed these waivers from the landowners where the pipe was going to be put in. Well, that kind of, if you were starting fresh, that goes without saying that by granting you the easement, they're kind of providing the waiver. The fact that there's a stipulation in law and a set distance, 500 feet, whereby they need a waiver, I mean, that should be pretty obvious, it seems like to me, that means for neighbors of this who have no other point of saying no in the granting of an easement. And so I can't help but believe that they knew they should have been getting waivers from these people when they go right by their house, regardless whose land they're on.
And this issue, we did flesh that out a little bit at the hearing as well. They said when they went through and did basically the whatever prospective land search they did or title search or whatever they do before they put in one of these pipelines, the names of these homeowners didn't show up because they weren't the landowners on which they we're going to put the pipeline.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So I think that provides some explanation as to why this may have occurred the way it did.
But in looking ahead to an order, there will have to be a finding on all five of these that says something.
I would agree.
So that's where you got to flesh out some more detail on them, I would think.
Slippery.
Julie just pointed something out on hearing exhibit number 6. I believe that's the Kuster residence. They'd be the easement holders on this, so they'd be the landowners as to where the property goes through, as well as the residential occupants. And on there, it shows that they have refused refuse both the waiver for sure, and it appears to be the easement as well. So that may be a good guinea pig to get in to see what exactly transpired there with regard to them.
So Julie Prescott, you're saying that, just to clarify again, that the Keister family, number 5, is in fact their property that the current pipeline goes through. That's what you're saying.
As per Exhibit 6, this is from the hearing.
Okay.
That this table shows that they are the landowner where pipeline is located, and they're listed as having refused.
Okay. Well, and that's where I was kind of going towards, is that that's a major swing, a potential swing in precedence on how we approve pipelines, because I remember specifically the Bakken Link pipeline, where there was landowners who didn't want the pipeline, and I would never been part of making a landowner take a pipeline across their line, because there's always an alternative. They just go around their property. So it'll be interesting to see how that one plays. You remember that you were in the Bakken Link, weren't you, Pat? We had some of those landowners that didn't want it, and we didn't approve that corridor, and the company ended up making changes that were longer, but they avoided those landowners. So, anyway.
I'm sure that's good. It may have been Sarah that was working on that one.
Okay. Mm. But pipeline law is much different than power line law, was my point, the way I understand it.
Okay. Well, this is the biggest issue in this case, clearly, these landowners who are refusing to sign the waivers. And
I would agree.
And it's the biggest concern I have. And so if there are some of those out there that are, you know, on the fence or just haven't signed or whatever, it's unclear. But right now it looks like there's five of them. And I'm not very inclined to approve that route and say that there's no reasonable alternative when that hasn't been shown. So
how would our process work in evaluating whether there's a reasonable alternative? If the company says, well, we've talked to these landowners and they say, no, it's got to be where it is or they won't allow it, so there's no other alternative. But are we able to somehow subpoena or do something else? Because we don't have that landowner in front of us. We don't know if it's just a matter of if they got an extra $1,000, they let it go out a little further, or whether there really is no other alternative.
Right. I guess the term reasonable, as far as the law goes, it's an objective standard, which you have to kind of look at the totality of the circumstances and say basically, reasonable is defined as the way you would imagine it's defined. It's something that if it makes sense or is satisfactory to what you believe would satisfy that criteria, you could go ahead and approve it. As far as a procedural aspect of that, you'd have to make that decision with what's been supplied on the record in this and what the company's supplied to us through these late-filed exhibits and from the hearing. So after evaluating that, you'd have to then make your findings in and have them supported by what's already on the record.
So if it comes down to that decision, we're going to need to request additional late file exhibits with a detailed explanation of all the efforts that were made to do an alternative route, including, you know, dollar amount offers and things like that to go farther away from these homes. Or is there another way to make that evaluation?
I guess that would come down to what would satisfy what is reasonable to you. Your decision on
Plus
this...
and the appeals judge.
And the appeals judge. The appeals judge would only overturn it if it's arbitrary or capricious or unreasonable finding. So it would have to be... You have to have at least enough evidence to meet that standard, that arbitrary standard moving forward. So based on that, I guess it comes down to what a judge would feel is reasonable evidence to support your finding as to no reasonable alternatives.
Well, do we even have a mechanism for the company to provide that at this point? We didn't request that in a late filed exhibit, and they didn't provide it at the hearing.
Right.
And they know the law and what's required. I mean, they clearly knew that was the standard, that they had to show that there was no reasonable alternatives to their going exactly where they're at.
Right. I guess I believe what was discussed at the hearing when this was brought up is when it was put in, it was a gathering line. So they had different standards that they had to abide by for that. I guess, you know, with what they presented, it appeared to be that the whole reasonable alternative to the 500-foot issue wasn't really pertinent to them at the time because it was a gathering line. So as far as determining a reasonable alternative to their current route, it wouldn't have been necessary when it was built and all the lines in the ground.
But this application and the hearing was about the conversion.
Right.
So what they knew and the understanding when they constructed it is one thing. Their their purpose through this was to show that there's no reasonable alternative, or get the waivers or show there's no reasonable alternative. And it, without that evidence on the record today, maybe I'm going to go through and find out what we've got, you know, more specifically in the hearing, recording, et cetera. Do we have a mechanism for them to provide additional information showing there's no reasonable alternative? We've asked for a map depicting location of 5 residents who declined to execute waiver.
I'm thinking, to answer your question, there's some room within these descriptions to obtain some more information. To answer your question, especially with, you know, some type of clarity to the map. So there may be potential for a supplement to that late filed exhibit to obtain some more information on that, just to supplement the map. As far as, you know, just adding an entirely new late file, that wasn't something that was discussed at the hearing. So
there's a process for that too. So we don't have to get, if we want something added to the record, there's a process to do it.
Well, I'm certain they're listening.
It's up to them to figure out they get the waivers or there's maybe more information.
I just, to be clear, to approve, for me to vote to approve this route and deem that there was no other reasonable alternative, it would take more than just the company's sworn testimony that there was no other reasonable alternative. And it's not that I don't believe them. It's because everybody has a different definition of reasonable. And so I'm going to need some details on what the reasonable alternatives they explored and were unable to put together before I could approve it.
Sure. If I could just throw this some thoughts perspective out there, I've been involved in other cases that dealt with this. And I'll give you an example. When I've never been able to find, there's not a reasonable alternative in a prairie crop space, you can find somewhere else to go. But you start getting into pinch areas crossing a river where there's cultural resources on either side or water bodies on either side, it's easier to determine that this is the most reasonable because of all those other constraints. But absent of constraints, there's no reason they can't go other areas. So that's where the constraints, to me, becomes a big issue. If there's constraints along this route, but I didn't see any constraints. So.
And maybe there are, but we don't know of them yet.
But that's the kind of the same thing you were going towards.
All right, we're inching up here on 3:30, and we try to keep these to an hour. So do you want to just quickly mention the last two, Brian, exhibits that were filed?
Sure. Exhibit number 6 is a short memo and a map depicting what would happen in the event of a spill at the Vance residence. The simulation was performed by Integrity Solutions Limited. It's a company that appears to be headquartered out of Littleton, Colorado, so it appears it was an independent study that was done for this. The findings of the simulation showed that there would be no impact on the Vance's actual house in the event of a spill. It seemed like the leaked material would come up near the home but wouldn't actually affect the home. There were some roads that appeared to hold back where the spill would happen. If that were the case, the company also...
How does a road hold back a spill that's underground?
Well, you know, that's a good question.
We're not talking about flooding and water.
Right, I guess I don't have the answer to that. There is some further explanation on their methodology in that memo. A lot of it I didn't exactly understand, I guess. They talked about a one inch depth thing. Maybe Julie would have a little bit better idea of what they're talking about with some of this stuff if you had an opportunity to review this memo.
They did somewhere talk about, and I'm not sure if it was actually in here or in one of these reports, where migration actually follows the pipe underground first before coming to the surface because it's past the path of least resistance along the pipe. So we don't have the model, so we don't know what their inputs were, and we don't know. This is all we received as far as mm-hmm. the request for the modeling. So they're just talking about a one-inch depth on the surface, how far would it spread. It's they don't show on here, you know, culvert locations on the road, how that would be impacted.
Also on this map, it was too, this map was really hard to read as well, so the company should resubmit that at a higher resolution so we can get a better sense of exactly what the model says.
And should also be noted that they did a simulation if the pipeline was moved to 500 feet away from the residence on there too, and that those results are also shown, and it doesn't appear that the Vance's property would be affected in that scenario.
And then what about the, I think Commissioner Kalk, you had requested a blast radius as well. Is there some testimony from the Vance's attorney that there have been explosions on pipelines in the past in that area? And
yeah, I remember that because it was, this is crude, it's not gas, but we wanted something added that would show it wouldn't be like a natural gas line. Yeah. I remember that, yep.
So that we don't have, or you
right,
want to talk to the company about that.
Right, and their late-filed exhibits aren't all in yet either, so there may still be some additional information okay. that they're going to be receiving from K2 with regard to these as well.
Mm-hmm.
When I talked to Jillian at Sound Lake, they were still in the process of getting that information from their consultants. So.
Besides the leak not impacting their home, there was also an issue, was there not, that they brought up that they have two, I think it was, wells in their yard that were not acknowledged in the report? And does that study mention any potential impact to those wells at all?
Not to my recollection. I don't remember seeing anything about wells when I read through it.
I didn't see anything about wells either.
Okay, so that's the on our list of late filed exhibits, that's number 7. But under the exhibit list in our docket, it's labeled as 6.
Yes, that's kind of what I was explaining at the beginning of the work session, how the numbers aren't perfectly correlated here. So just something to keep in mind when mm-hmm. looking through it.
And then the last one?
The last late file that we've received to date as late filed exhibit number 7. It appears to be the results of the pig and hydrostatic testing that's been completed to date. There's hundreds upon hundreds of pages of reports mm-hmm. in here. Basically, just they say what date the specific segment was inspected, and then how's the report, I guess. There's a lot of information in here that's kind of outside the realm of what I can really accurately comprehend. A lot of it's in, you know, their own code that I'm sure that they understand quite well. There's an executive summary with it. It doesn't appear that any of the information that is provided in these pigs led to any extensive repairs or anything like that. It does seem like there were some inspections that arose out of the mm-hmm. pig testing, though, due to deformities.
Can Pat and Julie, can you review that and translate it into, you know, layman's terms as to what the results of those tests actually shows?
Okay.
And I think they had mentioned in the hearing that the testing had resulted in them doing some on-site testing of spots on the pipeline, too.
At the hearing, they specifically talked about one area where there was a mistake with an error with the actual pig, I believe, which led to a dig, and they went in and dug it up, and the pipe was fine where they, I guess, evaluated it after the test.
And that doesn't seem to be unusual. We've heard that from other companies as well, where sometimes they go and check and everything is fine, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Anything else?
I don't.
That's all for me. So we'll probably get the draft order, and then we have some more information yet to come in, so we'll have to schedule another work session.
Okay.
All right. Thanks.
We'll close the official work session. Thank you all.